Welcome to the Cauldron Series with Dr. Barry Goff, a deep dive into the turbulent and transformative decades of British Columbia's past. In this episode, we turn our attention to communications, the lifelines of a growing province in the late 19th and early 20th century. As British Columbia emerged from isolation and pushed towards modernity, the arrival of telegraphs, postal routes, and eventually wireless signals reshaped how people connected across vast, rugged landscapes. Dr. Goff explores how these evolving networks influence politics, commerce, and community, and how the struggle to communicate mirrored the struggle to define British Columbia's place in a changing Canada. Without further ado, Dr. Barry Goff and communications during the Cauldron.
So the world was shrinking. The world was becoming one. It was being bound together by an empire of steel, railways. It was also linked across the vast spaces of the world by the steam engine and also by the sailing ships, because even in the late 19th century, it was cheaper to send freight by the Great Clipper ships than it was in steam vessels, where you didn't always know where coal could be acquired for the voracious boilers that were driving these ships. This meant that military equipment, guns, military personnel, garrisons could be sent very quickly from A to B, so that London was linked to Halifax, and Halifax was linked to Montreal, and Montreal was linked to Vancouver, and then to Victoria. So all of a sudden, Victoria is and Esquimalt are in a east-west link, where previously, all to this point in time, before the CPR comes into existence, it's a north-south and Pacific approach. So our communications have dramatically changed British Columbia's situation, and they've made them non-insular, I should say. They've made them open to the Pacific traffic. They have now, technology has now overcome the limits of geography in these certain special ways. On another occasion, I have talked about the Trans-Pacific Steamship Services of the Empress vessels and their precursors that go back to the 1880s. It's well to remember that once the CPR was being built on the Pacific side of the Rocky Mountains, Adam Onderdonk called for Chinese coolie labor to be brought in under contract to build the railway up through from the tidewater up through the mountains. And this was done. So the CPR ships become the vehicle. And if you look at the communications, they're coming from Guangzhou, Canton, and they're coming directly into Vancouver. And then they're being deployed almost amazingly that well. A footnote to that is in the First World War, thousands of Chinese were sent on the same passageway right through Canada and out the other side across the Atlantic to engage in the work of the engineering corps and building railways and digging trenches on the Western Front. So this all red route was coming into a magnificent strategic advantage for the British Empire. The Australians and New Zealanders were also interested in establishing links across Canada. And a worthy work by a fellow by the name of J.H. Hamilton called the All Red Route, 1893 to 1953, explains the historical details of this trans-Pacific mail service between British Columbia, Australia, and New Zealand. This parallels the evolution of the trans-Pacific cable system, which runs from Banfield into Asia ports and into Australia and then New Zealand. But in Hamilton's work, he shows us successful application of steam to the operation of ocean-going vessels. It had been finally demonstrated, he says, that a steamship was practical for a long sea voyage, and that it was possible for steam-propelled vessels to make such a voyage with greater speed and regularity than sailing vessels. Supremacy of the sailing ship for transportation of heavy cargoes was not at first challenged, but mail and passengers, carried under relatively high tariff, traveled increasingly by steamers. So then we get the great lines like the Cunard Line, which still exists. That was established by Nova Scotia's Samuel Cunard. We get also the famous linking of the P&O Line, Peninsular and Oriental Line, which worked up a fast passage across through by way overland first through Egypt and through Suez, and then after the Suez Canal was built and Britain had to have a control of it and bought out the French on that, that passage linked India very quickly with the Mediterranean and with the British home islands. So again, on that side of the world, they're getting closer to us here in Victoria and Vancouver. It's a fantastic history. Then we get on the east coast of South America, we get steamship companies there. And on the west coast of North and South America, we get the Pacific Steam Navigation Company. It's inspired by the Brits and developed by the Aspinall firm. And it links everything on the coast from South America to Panama by way of links with Chile and Peru, and then West Coast, Mexico, and then to San Francisco, and the wild jump off to the isolated Victoria and Esquimalt. The preference is always in these trades to go to San Francisco and to Portland, and Victoria and Nanaimo, New Westminster, and Vancouver were the end of the line in most of these cases. The Royal Navy took a lively interest in the establishment of these and similar passenger lines. They visualized that the speedy steam-propelled ships, which could readily be converted to naval use in time of war, would be a valuable asset. So many of the CPR Empress vessels were arranged to be armed merchants, steamers with gun mounts available and perhaps guns being held in the hold and used. And in the First World War, Canadian Pacific Empress ships were manned and armed and used as merchant ships. And in other cases, the other vessels were used as hospital ships or troop ships. To bring this all together, then, the world is becoming closer. The military possibilities, the strategic possibilities, the alliances were being forged so that ships did not longer, in a military sense, have to be on distant station and stay there forever. It was for this reason, then, that the Royal Navy reorganized all its arrangements in the Pacific Ocean. In 1902, the British Foreign Office established an arrangement with the Imperial Japanese government to form an alliance so that if one was attacked, the other one would come to its aid under a legitimate reason for doing so. That was one aspect of it. It frightened the British Columbians because they were concerned about Japanese immigration. The riots of 1907 in Vancouver opened up this great sore in the relationships between the Orient and the Occident, and we've talked about that in other cases. The coming of the CPR steamships and the Empress ships allowed two incredible introductions to British Columbia that had never possibly been imagined. One was human trafficking and smuggling of Chinese into Canada, which explains why British Columbia began as early as the 1870s to champion the argument that British Columbia had to control its immigration. It constantly was trying to cut down the communication links between China, Guangzhou in particular, and Vancouver. The other thing that comes in, and quite legally in those days, I should add, was opium. And this opium was coming from India. It was packed in coconut shells. It was heavily guarded and very valuable product. And it was coming to Vancouver in the same ships that the CPR was bringing in their Ember ships. So bring about 333 Chinese per trip to cargo, with tea, of course, with Nankins and other specialty items from East Asia, had as this precious thing opium. And those two things were running side by side, and it's at the basis of this problem, which is never resolved properly, that the Great Riots occur in 1907, and then of course Mackenzie King sent out, and the anti-opium arrangements are finally entered into. The introduction of Chinese persons is not closed down until the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1923, which doesn't deal with Chinese persons here, nor does it totally control the immigration of Chinese here and in the Pacific Cordilleran. But it has been made much of in the history of the of human rights in British Columbia, the white man's province idea. I conclude, therefore, with one further really important aspect. When in 1896 and 97, gold is discovered in the Yukon, the communications immediately go north. The Collins Telegraph line remnant that I referred to is hooked up, and it is rearranged, and it's in working condition, so that Dawson and is connected with the wider world in telegraphs. And this helps. The Mounties are doing their jobs there. It helps save lives. It helps in the communications. It helps in the evolution of the government. So communications are bridging geographical difficulties. In addition to this, of course, are the steam navigation companies that are quickly and rapidly coming forth. It's a fabulous history. I don't know why anybody hasn't written a great maritime history of the Yukon Gold Rush. It'd be a great PhD student for a subject for a student interested in maritime history. And great books have been written. We need a Samuel Eliot Morison to do the history of the Yukon from the point of view of the sea trade. Now, I started with James Cook, and I'm finishing with the Yukon story, because we've got this tremendous technological revolution, which is driving commerce. It's making things smaller. It's shrinking the world. And I conclude now by saying that in the year 1901, wireless is introduced. That means that, as was the case with the HMCS Rainbow in 1914, a message could be sent across the surface of the water to about a range of 200 miles. That was sort of an optimum. Later on, it increases. But this meant that ship-to-shore communications were readily available, and ship-to-ship arrangements were now readily available. But they were expensive. There weren't enough engineers to be able to develop this easily. The Navy, Royal Navy, and the United States Navy were the leaders in this, because they were interested in ship deployment. This meant that Esquimalt, as a naval base, could be wound up, and that the number of ships here were no longer needed, and they were sent to China to deal with a rising threat, perhaps possibly on account of the fact that the Japanese were worrying that the Russians were going to attack, which in fact they did in the year 1904. So wireless is extremely interesting in this whole shrinking. When I started my sailing activities in the 1950s on the British Columbia coast, we had no such communications as this. We did later get a means whereby we could have a on Channel 16, we could have inter chat with other vessels or go to other radio bands. And the Coast Guard was monitoring number 16 as well and saved many alive in consequence of that. Then, when I was sailing on Lake Huron in the 1980s, Loran had come into existence. And that's the intersection of two radio beacons. And when you have the two radio beacons in an intersection, then you know your position. You can decode it. Then, not long after that, came GPS. And that was an invention of the United States Navy. But immediately it was introduced, it was slightly inaccurate because the Navy did not want precise positionings to be made and disclosed to other readers because they still were using it as a means of targeting a future place for attack. Nowadays, of course, we've jumped over that. We've got EPRBs. And we have all sorts of means of ship to shore and intership communications and electronic maps, which we didn't have before. So, to conclude, the communications revolution has been extraordinarily important in British Columbia's history. It's ended our isolation, it's made our do ways of doing business quicker, it's increased our safety, it has diminished some of the natural hazards, which still exists, and we still live in a wild and dangerous oceanic frontage here. But the whole story that I'm talking about comes in the Cauldron period, 1871 to 1914. This is the period of the great transition, the great passage. So to conclude, I'm Barry Goff. I'm the creator of the Cauldron series. I'm supported by wonderful persons, including my quarterback, Greg Scott, to whom I give praise. And we hope you'll look at other episodes of the Cauldron series and see the vitality and the variety of stories that comes out of the Vancouver Island and British Columbia experiences of this amazing epoch of our history. And there's more to come. Thank you for your attention and stay tuned. Bye-bye.